Hey there, you're listening to 101.5 FM on UMFM. I'm your Tuesday 1 p.m. host, Ryan Funk. A very diverse episode today. One interview deals with film, the other, a Nordic ambassador. An award-winning documentary directed by Jennifer Holness tackles the often dangerous portrayals of black women in media. And the shift in North American beauty standards towards embracing black female aesthetics. Jennifer sat down with me to discuss the film and how to improve representation in our media.
Hi, my name is Jen Holness. I'm a writer, producer, and director, and I directed the film Subjects of Desire. I actually have my own production company, Hungry Eyes Media, and I've been sort of making film and television for the last 20 years.
That's something I'm wanting to maybe pursue in the future, get into more like productions and documentaries and thing. So what first got that bug for making media and documentaries?
So you know what it is that when I grew up, my mother, there was three of us, and we didn't have a lot of money. And so I didn't really understand how to make films or any way to get into the industry and so forth. I met my partner at York University, and he was in film studies. And that was what kind of opened up the idea that I could work in film and television. But when I first started out, I graduated from York University with a specialized honors in policy analysis and political science, a fancy political science degree. And I decided that I wasn't going to go into politics or become a lawyer, any of those kinds of things. And I just decided I was going to try film. And that was the thing. But what the backstory, though, was that growing up, I would write at home. I was a completely avid reader. And I didn't actually have those connections or see those connections. But then I read, for example, Stephen King on writing. And the fact that I was writing as a kid and that I was reading as a kid, that there was a natural like push in me around telling story. And so at some point, like I said, when I graduated, I decided to move and pursue that. And then I started out producing primarily. And then in my producing, I was always story editing. I was always writing stuff. And then I realized that I wanted to write, which is what I had been doing from a kid. And then I decided that, and I started doing that. And it helped that I had actually taught myself how to produce so that I was able to do the writing and the producing. And then on the documentary side, my very first professional project, I co-directed a documentary about Black Canadian history. And I was really, really jazzed about that project. And we did it with the National Film Board, and it really turned out well. And I wanted to direct more documentaries, but I had three kids. I was writing drama. I was, producing drama, and I was also producing other people's documentaries because I always loved documentaries, always kept a foot in it. So even though I wasn't directing, I was producing other people's docs. And then I guess in 2017, I made a decision that, my kids were older. I really had sort of probably not pursued this element of filmmaking, directing documentaries that I really loved and that I think I was, good at. I hadn't done that, and I decided it was time. And so that is how I ended up, after making my first documentary in 2000, to make this other, my second documentary, but a feature this time, starting in 2017 and delivering it in 2021.
Isn't that just fun how your path can just lead you to a certain spot that you didn't initially expect to reach?
My entire career is like that because, like I said, what I went to university for, I completely didn't do. But, I think what it is was being brave. When I graduated, my mother, I was invited to actually submit to law school. My grades were really good. I had the program I pursued. I could either go into business, I could go for an MBA, or I could go for on the law side. I didn't want to do that. But I think I was brave I'm not trying to toot my own horn. I was brave. I decided at a very young age, like, no, that's not what I want to do. I don't know what this film thing is, but it feels right. I went with my gut. I went with my instinct. And then I'm a really hard worker. And so what I did was I had to figure out what producing films was about. I had to figure out how do you write for, so I did that. You know, we didn't have a lot of mentors. We didn't have a lot of people who could support us. And we didn't know anybody in the industry, but that was not that important. What was important was how do I figure out how to do this work well so that I could make a living from it. So yeah, that was the mm-hmm. assignment, I guess.
Smaller production companies, they really turn, at least in my opinion, some of the most profound work. You're really invested in the communities and people. Like, you know what's going on. You got a feel for everything that's going on.
I've always been very community minded. And I do think that we have a problem in this country where we're really predominantly publicly funded, and we don't support the voices of all the people that make up the public. We haven't historically, and that's been a problem. And so being outside of the story engine of Canada, like in terms of my community and any focus on our stories, has really, it is a painful thing. I mean, people, everybody, every group wants to be seen and heard. We want to believe and know that we count. And being a part of the media world, that's it. You know, someone told me, and it's brilliant, it was Dr. Charmaine Nelson, she said, we know about slavery. Most people, 99% of people know about slavery, predominantly because of the movies they've seen. Very few of us, like, randomly will go into a bookstore and say, hey, man, I'm going to read this treatise on slavery, right? But yet we know a bunch of stuff about slavery. It comes from movies, you know? And so that's the power of media. That's the power of story and cinema. And so imagine spending most of your life where so few people have been given the opportunity to tell stories about your community, you know, and when they have done it, it's been very narrow. So it's maybe just been about slavery. It's not been about the nuances of, you know, like, what you might go through if you look like this as a Black girl, or if you come from this household as a Black boy, you know what I mean? And so I have been always community minded because my community has always felt disenfranchised from the larger system of media and what we get to tell and who gets to tell it. So I think, though, oftentimes that's where the beauty of the unknown comes. You know, you get like a story that takes you into a world or into a space that you thought you knew, and then you realize something incredibly pivotal or something personal. I mean, there's just a lot of story out there and there's an exciting times and where we're now starting to see the value. I mean, I didn't watch it, but all these folks watched Squid Game. I hate shows where people get murdered. Mm-hmm. You know, I hate murdering shows. I just, it's upsetting to me. You know, I read The Hunger Games because my kids were reading it, but I couldn't watch the movies because I just was so traumatized from the books. I don't like that extreme violence, but like with Squid Game, for example, everybody watched this show. And, you know, and guess what? That's because someone recognized story out of that community, out of those creators, was valuable to the larger, and it engaged people, right? And that's what we have to do. We have to expand our story world, and that comes out of community.
Representation in media is so powerful. Like, Encanto, that recently came out, has been amazing for the Latin communities, being able to see those stories, see people who look like you and you can relate to. It's so powerful. And I mean, for individuals like myself, we've had people in media who look like me for so long. So it's great to see, I guess it's a cultural renaissance in a sense. So, Subjects of Desire, what can you tell me about your film?
So Subjects of Desire is about Black women and beauty. but it actually looks at the fact that beauty is about power, like, and that if Black women were not considered the standard, like the standard of what is considered beautiful, and beauty is power, that is meant, what does that look like for Black women? It's also about the fact that they have been very dangerous, destructive narratives that came out of slavery and colonization with an agenda, these narratives, and that these narratives have now become so interwoven with how we see Black women and how we see Black culture, we don't even question them, but they're dangerous and they're destructive, and they create a mindset in Black women and girls where they don't love themselves, where they have challenges embracing themselves. And also, it actually gives power to people over them. So for example, just on a legal scale, it looks at the fact that Black hair, something that has really defined us as very different from whiteness, has been used to punish and ostracize Black women. You know, we have that moment where we talk about Bo Derek, and that when a judge ruled that you could discriminate against a Black woman for her hair, that a Black woman had to conform to what the office required, that she could not have her own natural style. The judge literally said, and this is a legal precedent, that look at Bo Derek. She had braids in the movie 10, and she took her braids out. So hair is mutable. Why is this Black woman trying to be like Bo Derek and have braids? Never mind that Black women for centuries have had braids, that Bo Derek and the producers were mimicking Black women, not the other way around. But that is used to actually cement in law the ability that if I go to the workplace with my hair in cornrows, my boss could say, you can change your hair because our policy is that we have to have this kind of hair. So this is the kind of stuff that's been happening to Black women. And then people turn around and says, well, why are Black women straightening their hair with chemicals? That's dangerous. They must be crazy. They must want to look white, versus the fact that society has actually made it almost impossible up until a certain point for Black women to walk around in the hair that God gave them.
With your film, how did you approach the subject? How did you want to, you know, kind of showcase these hypocrisies that are shared within our societies?
What I discovered when I was doing research, I wanted to do a comprehensive look at this because I felt that we had to understand historically where these narratives came from. So I felt that was very important. I felt like I couldn't just do a film and say, oh, you know, Black women are discriminated by their hair. I had to look at the source of things, right? So that comprehensive look, for example, showed us that, Black women and their hair was considered ugly. And then Madam C.J. Walker came along, and she came up with a methodology to press or straighten Black hair. And then straightened hair was progress. Straightened hair was professional. So that is out of history, right? But then why was Black hair considered ugly? Well, during slavery and colonialization, well, there was a narrative of the mammy. Fat, older, she had her hair wrapped up because it was untenable in some way, right? And that mammy was a caregiver. And that narrative of Black women, caregiver. I want to really go back and say, where did this stuff come from? And you look, most of the movies that have been made up until recently about Black women have been about, you know, essentially mammies, about maids, you know, Black women who are maids. That's it. And then, you know, the same thing with the sexualization. So I wanted to go back and look at all of those things first. So that's what I started at. But I also wanted to look at present day. So how did these things manifest themselves today? What does that look like? What does Mammy, Jezebel, and Sapphire look like today? You know, and, you know, it looks like the snip, snap, angry black woman. Oh my gosh, she's crazy. You know, it looks like the very sexualized black woman. And, you know, and other than that, it looks like that black woman who's fat and unattractive. And she's just there, though, to complain, but also serve. So look in media, up until recently, like all the roles literally filtered through those kinds of narratives.
If you go back far enough, all of this is tied to like white supremacy and oppression. And it's just, it's sad seeing that it is so present still to the modern day.
The unfortunate thing is that there's people invested in actually maintaining that. I mean, we've seen what's happened, you know, in the political landscape in America to some extent, where people are like, let's take out the knowledge or the information about some of these structures, and they call it critical race theory. Let's take it out. Let's not teach anybody this stuff. And let's just teach them, like, you know, the worst.
The whitewashed version.
And people are invested in doing this today. That's what's sad. That is what's sad. And so my film, hopefully, will be a counterpoint to some of this, you know?
How do we continue to move forward and dismantle some of these harmful and...
I think it's allyship. It's allyship, you know? For one thing, I mean, I hope my film really contextualizes things so that people who aren't, because these things are so ingrained, people don't really think about it. Like, you know what I mean? Because for example, for years, black folks were saying the criminal justice system targeted us. And the dominant culture was saying, oh, that's because you're at the wrong place at the wrong time. Or what were you wearing? or what did you say to that officer? And then these cell phone reveals started to show us that no, they weren't at the wrong place at the wrong time. They were just jogging down the road, you know? And so I think that my film in some ways is a little bit like that, in that it actually shows us some of these narratives. And it's then for folks to say, I understand this better about black women. I understand like these narrow confines in which they're being defined. I understand how my behavior, like when I don't believe a black woman, when I don't stand up for a black woman, when a sister is doing this and she's doing the most, but maybe it's like I might be the one that's threatened because she's like doing this thing and I'm like, I'm not doing this thing. So it's really about understanding first and foremost, and then saying, I'm going to stand up for you. I'm going to be there in your corner, or I'm just going to sit down and have a conversation with you. And that conversation is not going to be about what that sister can do for you, but who are you? What floats your boat? You know, what's going on in your world? And I think ultimately I'm a filmmaker because I'm inherently a hopeful person. I truly believe that in spite of some of the things I'm seeing unfolding over the last 4 or 5 years, I truly believe that our progress is possible when it comes to race and when it comes to structural and systemic racism. I truly believe that we can really work and solve this. I mean, you know, I don't know if you've seen this, but like Saturday Night Live does this thing with Tom Hanks where he plays like a country bumpkin, and there's other black like country bump like black folks, and then the whole thing shows us how much like white country bumpkins and black folks are completely similar. Like they like the same food. They're like, there's a whole host of things that they really do have a lot more connections than not. And so I don't know. I'm always hopeful that this getting together, this communicating will actually expose and allow people to explore that they have more similarities than they have differences.
What do you think we can do to keep our media and society accountable for, you know, moving towards progress and acceptance and representation.
You got to hold them accountable. You have to challenge them. You have to say, you know, I did an article with the Globe interviewed me, Sarah Tye Black, who's just a really wonderful journalist. And she asked me, and I said, you know, we have to have gatekeepers, and we have to hold the gatekeepers accountable. And, you know, so what that means is that we have to challenge them. So rather than saying, oh, I have my film and it's doing really great or whatever, and I've arrived, I'm actually putting it out there that we have to hold these people, the decision makers, accountable. So what we have to do is that sometimes it might not be in our full interest to actually hold people accountable, but we must do this. You know, it's like my children hold me accountable. They say, Mom, Dad, you've ruined this planet for us. The environment sucks. We can't maybe get homes. You know, we don't, you know, they're worried, you know, and my children are holding me accountable. And so what that means is that when, you know, one of them became a vegetarian and one of them became vegan, we embraced that. And we then like shifted our eating habits, which, by the way, for being Caribbean, it's like, they're like, are you crazy? So that's me being accountable as much as I can. So we have to hold, because for example, my children hold me accountable. And so we must say to the institution, also have to look at what was promised. What are people saying that they intend to do? And if they're not doing it, we got to go back to them and say, hey, man, you said this. We're not seeing this. You know, we also have to be honest, we have to actually stop this madness where people think that there is no truth. And what I mean is like, it's this truth, it's that truth. No. Some things are true. And for those things, we can stop explaining away and, you know, like there's too much acceptance of falsehood. And when we come across it, we have to say, this is what's happening. We have to stand up for what is right. We have to stand up for each other, and we have to stand up for, what is a true thing. Is there a systemic problem with Black men in the criminal justice system? Absolutely. Do they get different sentences for the same crime? Absolutely. You know, are they profiled at a higher level? Absolutely. These are truths. And so what are we willing to do to make that not be the case? Right? And that's what I'm trying to say, is that so we have to really hold our gatekeepers responsible for what they say that they're going to do. And we have to also stand up when we see a truth being dismantled or broken, or we're creating some alternative version of reality to justify injustice.
We got to stand together on these things, because, you know, the way things are going, we can't just let things continue. Like, the status quo is just not acceptable. Like, Subjects of Desire, it's a first step in kind of bringing awareness to the problems that we're seeing within our media and society, and now people can see it and they can be inspired to work together towards greater things.
That's my hope. That's definitely one of my goals and hopes. You know, I want, you know, young Black girls, for example, to watch this film and understand that they're not at fault, that the things that they're feeling are actually true and they come from a certain place. I want young white girls to say, okay, this is my friend, and this is how I can be a better friend, because now I understand certain things about, you know, what's happening here, you know, pretending that these things don't exist or whatever. I want those things to be, you know, to fall away. And so, yes, I'm hopeful. And I know that in the screenings that I've had, and, you know, the conversations people have brought to me about the film, I do think that it's actually having some great impacts in this way. And that, I mean, as a filmmaker, to have impact, to know that people are watching your work and seeing value and actually getting something from it that they can bring to their lives. I think it's very powerful to me, and I feel very, very grateful for that.
Well, Jen, it's been so great talking with you. I've had a lot of fun learning about your life and just, you know, discussing like the real things in reality that we need to be focusing on and challenging. Where can people go to find out more about Hungry Eyes Media and Subjects of Desire?
Okay, so Subjects of Desire is going to be on TVO on Feb 1st. And I believe there's a couple of repeat dates. In the US, it's going to be on Stars on Feb 26. Hungry Eyes Media, we are hungryeyes.ca.
I'm excited. The trailer was so good. I'm really excited. I just projects like this, like challenging your own thoughts. Like, I grew up in Winkler, like a small rural town. Getting out of there, like, I realized, like, wow, I had a lot of ingrained biases that I never realized. And, you know, getting challenged on those and, you know, see, just interacting with people has been like,
I think people just have to get out of their spaces. You know, this is one of the challenges of COVID, of course, is that it's keeping us really insular. And I know that, like, my mom was like a single mom raising three kids. And so we didn't have a lot of money. And when I was old enough, I think when I was 15, we went to Montreal on our own, my sister and I, and then we went to New York, and then we were like in Miami. And then when I got older, I was able to travel to Europe, and traveling, and of course, going back to Jamaica, but traveling in these spaces, talking to people, finding out about how people live, it really shrinks a lot of the misunderstandings. And so it's great that, you know, you speak of your own journey and like and acknowledging that there were these biases, because they are, because that society puts them into you. Kids are not born, you know this, they're not born, you know, like biased against someone. Society does this. So, but I do think stepping out of your comfort zone, reaching out to someone across the aisle, sometimes it's actually scary and sometimes it might not work out, but that, you know, I mean, I've reached out to Black people who have not been necessarily welcoming to me, but I've also reached out to Black people who have been incredibly welcoming and who have made my life a better place to be in this space. So, you know, that's the thing I just keep saying to people, you just got to push yourself to get out of your comfort zone.
And not just the mindsets of learning different people, their thoughts, beliefs, and experiences, but cultural food.
Well, that's the exciting part. Today at the office, we have a young lady who's Nigerian. And so I've never tried Nigerian food, right? And so like my partner bought a bunch of, so, you know, so we're, you know, it's like some of it, it's, you know, you're going to love it. And some of it, you're going to be like, mm-mm, but at least you're trying it.
Yep. That's something I've been so excited about. Like, there's so many like really cool restaurants right where I live in Winnipeg. And, you know, when things open up a little bit more, Got to check them all out.
That's right. Get out there in the bag. Get that, you know. Yeah. You know what's so fun? I have to go too. When I go to small towns in Ontario, for example, every once in a while, you go into a small town and there'll be a restaurant and then they'll have like some kind of like Caribbean dish. And of course, white owners. And it's like, and then you find out that they came from Kensington Market, which is like this really cultural hub in Toronto. And then, but they've gone to this small town and then they're bringing this really cool ethnic food into that community. And I love that. Those are my favorite experiences when I go out of my, you know, into, you know, different spaces. Cause I'm a downtown Toronto girl. But you go into these rural spaces and then you find like these gems or like people who make butter or, you know, people who bake stuff. Like, I don't know. So food is to me is like, it'll save us all.
This past Thursday, Winnipeg had a special guest with the Swedish ambassador to Canada. I met up with Sonia Lundström, the Swedish Cultural Association president, and Anders Swanson from Winnipeg Trails Association to talk about the Swedish ambassador's visit.
Okay, getting to that, They all have Kixleys. Everybody's got a Kixley.
You're from Yukmouk, Sonia?
I am.
Your family? Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, Yukmouk's up there. Totally,
These old people, they gotta have their Kixley. Did you meet some of the people inside that have lived all their life on Kixleys from Sweden, Anders?
Yeah, I met a bunch of people inside. By that point, everybody was talking about the pickerel, but I didn't get a chance to talk about that. I did hear the ambassador talk about it though, and he knew what he was talking about for sure.
Yeah, no, I had an opportunity to chat with him, and he was talking a little bit about, you know, how they clear the road so that they can go in, and they stopped using salt, and then they just started using Kixleys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. He really knew about that connection between infrastructure maintenance and technology and sort of this whole return to more, let's say, sensitive ways of treating snow. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, I love that. I saw there. I wish they'd do it here.
Yeah. Sometimes, like, you just go out and, like, there's just salt and sand everywhere, and it just gets so annoying. And like, specifically like for pets, if you're bringing a pet outside, some of that sand or salt can be very dangerous for their paws. Like, it can cause burns on them.
It was really neat because, an ambassador, like, he's a politician. I don't know what his sphere is, but like, just kind of to have that kind of knowledge when you're like the ambassador, like, you might as well, I don't know, he could be in the Treasury Board. He could be whatever. Like, he just happens to know that very specific linkage.
Yeah, I mean, maybe his family or himself were like city civics kind of thing.
I think you really notice when you kind of, he was mentioning, because he was saying how like he's in Ottawa, right, and all the pavement is black, and it's a weird thing in the winter to see that for sure. It's like, how, like, this shouldn't be, because it's cold in Ottawa, like it's not on the coast.
What did you think of him, Anders, of Urban?
He's a champ. He did not want to do it, so that was good. You know, we hauled out those kick sleds, and he didn't want to just hide in the forks. He wanted to go and do it, and he wanted to go check out the river. You know, whenever you're hosting somebody and they're game to try it, it's always like, it's really nice, you know, because yeah, unfortunately they're doing construction on that, the underside of the Main Street Bridge. But I like taking people there, because when you're on the ice and looking up from that bridge, it's like this Batman cathedral and it's just a perspective of the city that you never see unless you're there, like specifically on the ice, and it just looks like a Tolkien kind of castle. Like, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but I wanted to take him there and for a picture, but it was all covered in an orange tarp.
Did anybody get a picture of Luca Roncerone's showers?
Kind of. So I know, like, a lot of people who do the maintenance at the forks, and two of them were in a truck carrying one of them, and they stopped and they're like, they saw the flags and they're like, are you doing stuff with is that the ambassador? I'm like, yeah. He's like, oh, you guys are probably looking for these, right? I'm like, yeah, kind of. They're like, yeah, we're just moving these. They'll be there in like 5 minutes. I was like, whatever.
You didn't get a picture.
I could have got a picture of him beside one on a big like bobcat, but it wouldn't be the same.
Would have been the same, yeah. So I guess just for both of you, what was that experience meeting up with the ambassador from Sweden? And I mean, some of the ambassadors from the other Nordic countries have come out as well.
Well, for me, it's just very exciting that the ambassador, if this hasn't happened for a long time, has taken the time to come and connect with the big Scandinavian population in this city. And that really fuels our fire to keep our culture and our heritage going. It puts fuel in our tank. But also, we're very excited to be open and learning, and that we can be the mode of communication of some of the initiatives that the Scandinavian countries, and how we can learn from them and they can learn from us. and really, because as immigrants, our Scandinavian people accomplished a lot here. And that can go with the exchange, can go back and forth, and we're enriching all society, I hope, as people and as our environment. And there's just so much to learn. And any way we can do it together, all the better. Anyway, see, I can get going here. But anytime you meet people with ideas, you can enrich whatever you're doing, you know, individually, collectively, as a community, however we can do it. We can do it. We can write about it. We can have individual exchanges.
What about you, Anders?
For the last 15 years or so, I've been kind of dedicating myself to two things, and that is bringing international best practices and active transportation design to Canada. To Canada as a whole and to Winnipeg specifically, and also with a specialty in winter. So I've, you know, met with different MPs and sort of national level politicians from Nordic countries before in the past, and been sort of paying attention to what's going on there, because they're often a glimpse at the near future for Canada. I've traveled to a few places specifically to learn about how they design cities. And so for me, it's, I mean, in the case of, you know, this gentleman as a person, it was just nice to have somebody from Sweden who you could talk to about policy a little bit and show them a bit around your hometown and who understood likely. And yeah, I wasn't let down in that sense. I think for Winnipeg Trails' Plain Bicycle Project, what we're getting known for is for like seeking out sort of the best in personal transportation that's human powered, and then bringing it like bringing ridiculous amounts of it here all at once in order to try to do something like that people start talking about. And the Kickslays part, we made a pretty big effort this winter to bring a ton of them. Only half successful thus far, but that's a long story. Specifically the ones from Sweden that are who knows where because they're in an accident. And so it was great to have a chance to focus specifically on this. And I really liked being able to hear, first of all, sort of see the excitement on Sonia and her colleagues, especially the ones who are aware of how well those are used and recognize them as an object, like, is there like a cultural artifact? Like it's, it would be like, you know, tasting maple syrup after 2 years of being in Mexico, or, you know, getting on hockey skates after a long, like seeing kick sleds is like, it's synonymous with a certain lifestyle and a certain way of understanding and living with nature.
Oh, Anders, that's so beautiful what you said.
Oh, that's what they pay me the big money for, Sonia.
I love it. Good too.
What can you tell me more about these Kickslays, Sonia? Like, they seemed so cool when I was watching and filming them going down the river.
I haven't had that much personal experience other than the homemade ones, because that's what I've lived on all my life. But they've just been a part of our life. And now I see these modern ones, and I want to get one. So I just think it's wonderful. And I when I was in Sweden, I was just so impressed with them. And I know they've been around for a while, but I think more than ever that it can be something that we could look forward to using. I would like to see, well, it's going to be a challenge when I get mine. Well, the streets are pretty good now, but I don't want to have to do it on concrete.
Do you think we can, you know, we can get this more, like, grow that interest here in Winnipeg? Because it just seems like something that would be great for, like, rentals and just getting people in the community to go down their streets when they're, like, going for a walk or something, getting people engaged.
Well, I don't know where to start. I just know how it was in Sweden, and it was so great. And I'm going to try and make it like that here. You know, there is the rivers, and you can go on them there, and there's the trails that I've been sizing up trails where I'm going to be going. But I want to be at kind of my day-to-day living as a place to commute, to visit friends, to go throughout the community, so I don't have to take a car and do my grocery shopping and things like that. And little trips becomes my active transportation. In the summer, it's my bicycle, and I just want this now.
Sonia is going to be is sort of one of our testers and one of our big boosters for us bringing these in. And I'm actually curious, Sonia, for you to try the Finnish one, the ones from Quebec, and the ones from Sweden, if they get here, just to see. They're a little bit different, but you're definitely right that a lot of it has to do with, there's a reciprocal relationship between having these in the city and how we maintain our sidewalks and roads. We have this kind of mentality it's interesting that we've got a writer here who's, you know, that we're talking to, but because Ryan, you might be interested to watch your own writing around winter and this kind of thing, just to look for some cue words. Like, I've been noticing this winter that as soon as we get lots of snow, like, the battle language comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people start talking about, like, fighting the winter and against it, and the crews are battling as hard as they can and this kind of thing. And then the end result is, like, scraping the road down to, like, scraping the living hell out of the roads to try and get down to the black asphalt that's underneath there. Mm-hmm. We're not focused on leaving a nice flat surface for pedestrians, for example, first. Like, we're really just trying to make the cars work and make the other machines be able to go as quickly as they can. And that doesn't work very well for kick sledding. And when you think that way, that's when you start to have to dump the, like, mountains of salt that Urban was talking about. Like I said, he's the ambassador to Canada. It's not his thing to know about salt, I don't think, and municipal sidewalk clearing, but he's absolutely right. Like, you need to treat snow as a kind of building material as soon as it sticks around, like, sort of mid-December. Like, if you can get it to stick around and you can start playing with that snow and building your city around it, it becomes a lot easier just to walk.
Oh, I love that, Andrews.
Yeah, I think that's just the struggle out here, like, North America. We have this mentality of controlling the nature and our environments, but we need to live more apart.
And living with nature,
mm-hmm.
with a part of it, being in it, you know?
That's very true, Sonia. That's really quite, that's totally what it is. But when life is art, then you, even your door handles become a nicer shape. And you're, you know, like, there's something. It's hard to.
I like, get like so excited.
Talk about IKEA, but what they don't realize about IKEA is that it comes from a really human scale. Not that IKEA itself is like that, but like long-term quality manufacturing, like right-sized fit thing. That's going on there that's really hard to kind of describe. Like, the fact that you can go for a sauna and it makes sense for you to be naked in the front yard in your suburban house. You know, it's different.
What are some other aspects of kind of these Nordic cultures and countries do you think we can apply to our life here in Canada, or at least approach or think about it and maybe adapt it to our life here?
It's in our blood to have this passion about being in nature. Okay, and like, I think the fact that we're out there today on the coldest day of the year and got all wired up and fired up and had such a good time, that says who we are and what we're about. And that we have this passion, and it's a connection, or I have that. Like, geez, I better be careful of generalizing, but I just love every winter's never lasts long enough. You know, it's just, and our passion goes right through to the summer. Like, okay, we go mushroom picking. And we never get a mushroom. We've had such a good time because it's a certain kind of bush that we have the memory of. To be in that bush and the smells and the everything about that bush where the mushrooms are.
That love for life and that love for nature, that's definitely something that we can all kind of take into account and apply to our own lives. Like, there's so many times where you go to Bird's Hill or go for a hike somewhere, you just feel like a tourist. Like, you're a tourist in that forest. You're not a part of it. You're not enjoying it. It's not your forest.
Oh, yeah. Well, they call it forest bathing, right? I've heard that word. I've been doing it all my life.
Well, there's some big social things as well, that social and political things that are wrapped up in it. Like, you'll notice that the ambassador talked about, I think the word he used was feministic approaches to some policies around snow clearing. That's absolutely true. And it comes from gender-based budget analysis. But the other thing that Nordic countries and, well, maybe maybe not exactly Winnipeg, but 100 kilometers east of here have in common, and a lot of Canada has in common, is that we're people of the forest, and the Nordic countries sort of spent a long time developing cultures around being in a forest and in a winter forest specifically. And so we have a lot to learn in terms of everything from, you know, crafting cross-country skis to sort of how we spend some time outside. But I think we also need to remember that Canada is also reeling from a relatively recent history of colonialism, specifically English colonialism, and that where the Nordic people were involved, but also sitting outside of that, at least the ones in Canada, where we were for sure part of it and living on stolen land, et cetera, and with a really complicated relationship with the Indigenous people. But that it's a little bit different than the Cartesian, mowed front lawn, grass, English, no insulation and keeping the doors open, drafty, kind of stiff upper lip, rules and regulations society that led to a lot of the choices that we make. And when you're asking, like, what should the Nordic countries, what should we learn from them? Well, there's a lot of things, but gender equality is one. Like, a long time ago, it was made illegal, for example, to advertise things specifically to boys and specifically to girls. There's a lot more gender parity in parliament there, in decision-making in general, like parental leave is longer. A lot of interesting stuff comes from those countries that we need to bring here, but it comes, I think, in part from a certain level of compassion for other members of society, and that I personally think that we're struggling a bit with colonialism in our past and how we treated other people and how we treated the land. Because I'll leave with one last thing. So the Sami, for example, are in northern Sweden and northern Finland, et cetera. They're right now going through their own form of reconciliation. So yeah. Europe's only indigenous people happens to be in the northern countries as well. Just pointing out that when Swedish people and Finnish people are walking around in the woods, they're using language for the thing that is beneath their feet that they know. They know where the word comes from. They know what it means. They know what the thing is. When you're a tourist, as you put it, in Birds Hill Park, it's largely because nobody bothered to learn Ojibwe or Cree.
Okay, but another thing, I have to say this. Okay, there's the cognitive connection, but there's the emotional and maybe spiritual connection. Like when you get, like, what? Okay, we all, we Swedes all go together to pick the mushrooms. and we just have such a joyous time because, you know, there's something in us that we connect with the smells and the feeling and the everything that's there in nature. I don't know how to explain it, but we just really have it heavy. And that's why we like to do it together, because we got the same feelings.
Before Ambassador Urban Ollen took a kickslay ride on the Red River in minus 38 weather, he shared some thoughts about what Canada and Sweden can learn from one another.
I think it speaks for itself. You know, it's made for winter. Isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and it's actually pretty fun to ride as well. To see if I can get this on. No, so it's fun. And as you see, there are different versions. As you can see here, this one has kind of more skis on it. Mm-hmm. See, it's more for the soft snow. You know, that is not that common in Sweden, though.
Okay.
I mean, what we have are this kind of skates, what do you call it? I don't know, Mia, we say in Sweden, I don't know.
Okay.
You know, when it's an iron, under a skate.
Yeah.
So that's what we use most of the time. But I think that's a good idea, though, for more softer snow, you know.
Do you think these kinds of activities should be adopted more in a city like Winnipeg, where winter is such a big part of our year?
I mean, it's up to the people in Winnipeg to decide what kind of means of transport they would like to use.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when we're talking about environmental issues, you know, we want to be climate friendly. This is a very climate friendly means of transportation, right? Mm-hmm. And as I said, it's you can use it for lots of different reasons. If you go out ice fishing, it's perfect because it goes fast, you know. And as I said, lots of older people back home is really using it when they go grocery, because you know they can sit down and have a rest. So it depends on what you can find a lot of different purpose of having it. So I'm not saying that, you know, Winnipeg should buy 1,000 of these and take away the buses or something like that. I don't think that's possible. But it is definitely a need for different means of transportation, whatever you do.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what you've noticed difference-wise between, say, Sweden and Canada when it comes to approaching winter and being outside in the winter.
First of all, you know, it's I mean, when Canadians look at Sweden, they see a country that is very far up north, okay? But, you know, the reality is that we don't have the harsh winters as you have here in Winnipeg. You really need to go up north, really up north in Sweden, to have this kind of cold weather as we have today. Where I come from, you know, this, I mean, maybe one day in winter we have this kind of cold that you have today. So it's a different kind of climate, and lots of Canadians don't understand that. But the Gulf Stream and the Atlantic, you know, is warming up the Scandinavian Peninsula. So Norway and Sweden is much warmer than Canada, even though we are much more north. So it's a different kind of setting, you know. And it's the same when we had a meeting yesterday, we talked about the Arctic. And Canadians believe that Arctic in the Nordic countries looks like the Arctic here. And it doesn't, you know. The northern part of Sweden, the Arctic part of Sweden is more like Winnipeg, you know. There are cities, there are railway stations, there are communications, there are roads, there are activities going on, right? So it's more like a simple part of, an ordinary part of Sweden. So it's simple as that. It's not a big difference. So I think, you know, Canadians can taught Swedes a lot about how to handle cold weather, because you have a much colder weather than we have. And you know, so I don't think Swedes are special experts when it comes to handling the winter. No, I don't think so. But it's good to have an exchange of views and, you know, see different kind of cultures and how you deal with stuff. I thought it was fun to come to Ottawa and learn how to dress properly when it's pretty cold outside. You know, it's kind of a new experience as well, so that's good.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And what kinds of things, being in Winnipeg, what kinds of things are you learning or experiencing?
The Nordic ambassadors were here for a meeting with, you know, the premier and ministers and so on. And what we have been talking about is the kind of cooperation where we can have a cooperation between Manitoba and the Nordic countries. So yesterday we spoke a lot about mining, how to make it more sustainable, more green, using, you know, electrical machineries in the mines, having more social inclusion into the mining. And in these areas, there are lots of commonalities between Sweden and Manitoba. We have the, kind of the same challenges. So I think there are lots of opportunities where actually the Nordic countries and Manitoba can work together when it comes to that. The fun thing with the kick sleigh is, though, that when I grew up, everyone had this, you know. So I have three on my own back home in my boathouse. So it's parked there. So I have three of them. And then for, you know, because we had it like you have here in Winnipeg, that, you know, the walkways have snow, right? So it's easy to ride the kick sleigh. And then we started using more of salt in the walkways. And when you have salt and you have concrete or asphalt, you can't really use them. So for a period of time, it went away. But nowadays, it's more environmentally friendly again. We're using less salt. And then the kick sleigh is coming back again into the Swedish kind of, call it, you know, tradition to use it. So I think that that's a little bit a part of the story, you know, that it's a kind of, we are reinventing them again, so to say, right? If you asked me 20 years ago, will we ever have kick sleighs again, I would say, no, that was in the 60s, you know. But it's coming back again due to that.
Yeah, and the point about the infrastructure is interesting, obviously, because we have like a range of different roadways and things like that. And
yeah. And you know, and it's also an important thing is here that maybe we have a little bit of different approach to flowing streets and so. You know, we have what do you call that? Studded tires. You know, so we are not. I mean, where I am here in Canada, in Ottawa, they pour out salt. So the roads are totally empty of ice, right? In Sweden, you don't have that. So we have studded tires. We tell people you need to drive carefully because it's winter conditions, right? And that is an environmental thing. You know,
I would say that the voters in Sweden would not accept pouring out so much salt on the street as you do here in Canada. I think there would be a lot of criticism against that, right? So we really, you know, tell people that it's your responsibility. You need to drive carefully during the winter. But we also, the first thing we plow is actually the walkways. Because we look upon it from a perspective that the kids need to go to school. And, you know, we need to look to other things than the cars need. So in many countries you look at, oh, the need for the car. You plow the roads first and then you do the rest, right? But actually in Sweden it's more focusing on, we want the people to use the walkways, they need to go to the work, so we fix that. And in Stockholm they even call it the feministic snow plowing policy, where they are, you know, looking into who is benefiting from plowing the roads, mostly men, plowing the walkways, mostly women. So they even call it, you know, a feministic snow plowing policy, that they do that first. And then of course then if you snow plow the walkways, then it's a good idea to have kick space.
Right, exactly. That fits into it.
Yeah, because you will have it like here, you know, easy to go. Yeah. Yeah. But it's a wonderful means of transportation, I would say, for older people. You know, it's not, I mean, in the downtown of Stockholm you won't find this. But in the countryside, in smaller cities, let's say 100,000 and below, you will find people using this all the time when they go to the grocery store. And it's, as I said, old people love it because they have the chair with them, right? So easy to skate, sit down, have a rest, get your grocery on, and, you know, go home.
And we're here with the Scandinavian Culture Center. I guess, what are your thoughts on, you know, having a community center like this in Winnipeg that celebrates all the Nordic countries?
Oh, I love it. I love it because, you know, the Nordic ambassadors back home in Ottawa, I mean, we have five. It's Iceland, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Denmark. And we work very closely together. Because we know that we are small countries, right? Sweden is 10 million people, the others are 5.5 and so on. And to make an impact in Canada and making us known, it's actually better that we work together. So if we come together, we can have a bigger impact, right? And that's the same with our visit here. I mean, if I go here alone, maybe I wouldn't have a meeting with the premier, right? But if I go with my Nordic colleagues, it's a better chance that we have good meetings. So we try to do that all the time. And, you know, coming here where you have lots of, I mean, Winnipeg was once upon a time the Swedish capital in Canada, right? Wherever you go, you hear Icelandic names and Norwegians' names and so on. So that the kind of the Nordic, what do you call it, mark here is pretty obvious. It's pretty obvious, I would say.
Want to hear more stories? Tune into 101.5 FM every Tuesday at 1 for U Talk. And why not check out U Multicultural as well? I'm Ryan Funk. This was U Talk. And have yourself a good one.